Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all sub sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many a days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more. While we seek mirth and beauty and music, light and gay, there are frail forms fainting at the door. Though their voices are silent, their pleading looks will say, oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many a days you have lingered all around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more.
That is Mavis Staples with Hard Time Come Again No More. That was recorded in 2004. It was written by Stephen Collins Foster, the man who is popularly known as America's first songwriter. But he died tragically with only 38 cents to his name in 1864 at the age of 37 years. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And it is February the 5th. We are going to have a wonderful presentation, which would be the first of two parts today. And it will conclude, of course, tomorrow. Our guest will speak uninterrupted for 30 to 35 minutes. And then we'll have a question and answer session after a very teeny, teeny, tiny short break to have her catch her breath a bit. And then we'll take your questions and calls at 888-874-4888. In practically every area of life in the United States, race-based inequality remains significant, persistent, and devastating. A stark illustration is healthcare. African Americans today are sicker than whites at almost every income level. And if the death rate were about the same for both groups, between 80,000 and 100,000 African Americans would not die each year. In the first of this two-part presentation, law professor emerita Vernelia Randall from the University of Dayton and author of Dying While Black will discuss today the health status of African Americans and how a history of slavery, legal apartheid, racism, and racial re-entrenchment have led to health problems that cannot be corrected merely by eating right and exercising. What is needed, she argues, is a Human Rights Act for the 21st century that outlaws all forms of discrimination, including negligent and non-intentional discrimination. Professor Randall writes extensively on and speaks internationally about race, women's issues, and health care. She is the recipient of the Ohio Commission on Minority Health Chairman's Award. She's a public health professional as well. She administered a statewide health program in the state of Alaska. For the past 15 years, she has devoted her attention to eliminating disparities in healthcare for minorities and the poor. And it is my pleasure to have you with us today, Professor Randall. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Eutrice. This is a very important topic and very significant, given that this is the 50th year anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I was actually 16 years old when the Civil Rights Act was passed and had been raised in the South and had experienced not only segregation, but experienced violence against my family and based on race. And my grandfather, oftentimes when we talk about racial issue and slavery, people want to make it as if it was, you know, back at the time when the revolution started. But the reality for many African American families is that many people have knowledge of ancestors that are just two generations removed from slavery. My grandfather was born at the end of the Civil War. So my father actually knew his grandfather who was a slave. So for us, slavery is not a distant past. Segregation or legal apartheid isn't a distant past. How can it be a distant past when, in fact, I was raised in legal apartheid and experienced all my childhood life segregation? So the ability to, your invitation to talk about the Civil Rights Act and what is needed for the 21st century is really timely. And I particularly want to focus on health because I think health is an area where the impact of our history plays out in our, whether or not we want it to play out or not. So as I talk, I hope I will show to people, one, that African Americans, and when I use the term African Americans, I'm using it as a term of art. I'm not talking about anyone who happens to be black and in America. I'm talking about people who have at least one ancestor out of American, U.S. American slavery. Now, I do that not to minimize the experiences of others, but because my research is focused on those, that group of people. And I also want to make sure that I am in no way trying to build a hierarchy of pain. I'm not arguing that black people are sicker. In fact, I don't think that's true. I think Native Americans actually have some of the worst health statistics there are. And that's born out of their history. Nor am I arguing that you know that we should be building a hierarchy of pain. We all have our pain, and we all have our history. And so I will hope that you take this history and how it has impacted those of us who come out of slavery as evidence of our history and not as an attempt to put down anybody else's history.
Professor Randall, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. So being black in America is dangerous to our health. When I say that, what I'm saying is that if you look at the health statistics and the death statistics, the black health death rate, there are approximately 87,000 to 100,000, depending on the year that you look at, what is called, and this is a term of art, excess death. Now, excess death means that these deaths would not have occurred Now, if we had the same death rate as whites. Now, we're not saying people would not die. We're just saying they would not have died that year. How to put that in context? Well, think about it as a jumbo jet. Imagine that you filled up every day a jumbo jet full of nothing but African Americans and had one crash every day of the year. That's what it would take to have 80,000 to 100,000 deaths per year. This is a major catastrophe in African American lives, and it's not even something we talk about. These statistics also are borne out in life expectancy. One of the quotes that I like to use is a quote off of the CIA website. The CIA says that life expectancy at birth is a measure of overall quality of life in a country. Now stop and think about that for a second. Life expectancy at birth is a measure of overall quality of life in the country. Now, if we're going to use that standard with other countries, we should use that standard with our own country. And what we see here is that in America, black Americans, if they were a country, would have a life expectancy that would rank them around 75th as a country, okay, behind Barbados, the Bahamas, Jamaica. Now, white Americans are not doing all that well in these statistics. We're actually ranked, white American males are ranked about 30th behind Cuba. But black Americans are ranked 75th, black American males are ranked 75th behind Jamaica. White American females are ranked 29th behind the UK, and black American females are ranked 46th behind Cuba and the Barbados. So what we're actually saying, if we use the CIA standard, is that the quality of life for black Americans in this country is about the same as the quality of life as people in Barbados, the Bahamas, Jamaica, and Cuba. Okay? Now, that's astonishing when you think how rich our country is. Another standard that is used to measure the quality of life or the health status is maternal death, because maternal deaths are often seen as preventable deaths. Ireland is ranked number one in 2008, which is the statistics we have. White Americans is ranked 30th behind New Zealand and the UK, and black Americans are ranked 57th behind our Barbados, the Bahamas. Think about that. We have 31.7 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births compared to the Bahamas that have half that many. They only have 16. The other area of statistics that I want you to think about is low birth weight newborns, the percentage of babies that are born with low birth weight, okay? And the same pattern is playing out again. But one of the things that intrigues me with this is because we have had people say, well, at least life is better here than, and then they name some African country, okay? And the truth, the reality is, in when it comes to health, that is not always true. When it comes to low birth weight newborns, our statistics are lower than Rwanda, Ghana, Uganda, and Tanzania. We have 13.6% of our babies born low birth weight compared to 9% of Rwanda. So one of the questions I want to think about is, how were you aware of these disparities? And if you were, has these disparities impact you personally? And how do we do more than just prove health? One of the problems, especially yesterday, because tomorrow I'm going to talk about why Obama's health care is going to be almost totally useless for dealing with this problem. Because we often want to focus on improving the health of everyone, but improving health doesn't remove the gap. I'll say it several times during this presentation. A gap, you can raise, everybody on a ladder can go up 10 steps, and you've actually improved the position of everyone. But if I'm still 5 steps behind you, I'm still 5 steps behind you. I actually need to go up faster and quicker. And that's the problem we have. Because part of the problem is we're in an era where we don't want to deal with race. We have sort of a colorblind approach to racism. Now, it's important for me to talk about what I mean by race here. I know that race is a social construction, and someone's going to get on and say there is only one human race. And you're absolutely right, but that's about as meaningful as saying that there's only one world. Yes, race is a social construction, but it's a social construction that has biological consequences because of social isolation and because of racism. America is a social construction that may not exist in 1,000 years, but it has meaning right now. Race has meaning right now, and so we have to deal with that meaning as it exists. What I tell people is, the question always comes up, how do we know it's a race issue from a class issue? How, this may just be the fact that more blacks are poor. But you have to ask yourself, if you want to ask the question, is race an issue, you have to control for class. What you have to do is compare people of the same class. And the mistake that many people want to do is compare black people of different classes and say it can't be a race issue because, look, there are middle-class black people who are doing better than poor black people. Well, of course, class is math does matter, and class makes a difference. The relevant comparison to get at race is middle class blacks to middle class whites, poor blacks to poor whites. If you can look at poor blacks and poor whites and they're receiving the same treatment, then race is not an issue. But if you look at them and they're receiving a different treatment, then race is an issue. And how does that play out in health status then? Well, we know, for instance, with going back to the low birth weight statistics, we know that the percentage of low birth weight is so pronounced based on race that upper middle class black women who are who have more than 13 years of education, who are doctors and lawyers, et cetera, have more low birth weight babies than white women who didn't graduate from high school. I want you to think about that. Upper middle class black women have more low birth weight babies than white women who did not graduate from high school. One study showed that low-income whites live 3 years longer than low-income blacks, and that middle-income whites lived 10 years longer than middle-income blacks. So clearly, there is a race difference. and not just the class. To put that in context, why is this occurring? Before I can go into why I think this is occurring, I have to make sure that we are on the same page about racism, because I want to talk about colorblind racism. And so racism is both about actions and attitudes, conscious and subconscious, that subordinates an individual or a group. It can be both acted individually or it can be acted institutionally, but at its core is power. The power to, and I have to make this clear, I don't mean necessarily formal power. I believe that people can have informal power and they can exercise that informal power in a way that is designed to subjugate an individual or a group. And then institutional racism is also about system of procedures and practices and patterns that have the effect of discriminating. So we have the old-fashioned racism where you have the overt belief in white superiority, the promotion of segregation, the belief in the biological-based intellectual inferiority. A prime example of the old-fashioned, but now we have colorblind racism. Increasingly covert racial discourse. People, to talk about race is to be racist. You can't imagine how many times in the last 10 years I've had people call me a racist because I talk about race and what is happening. So you have a complete avoidance of racial terminology. And also this kind of claim that they experience whites experience reverse discrimination. And this kind of reverse discrimination is always caught in the idea that they believe that some white, black person who did not deserve something got something that they deserved. The avoidance of direct racial references in political matters. The invisibility of racial inequality now. Most people don't even recognize that the racial inequality is so persistent and so prevalent. And the re-articulation of legal apartheid, or Jim Crow as it's known. This is not an issue of conservative versus liberal. You have conservative colorblindness and you have liberal colorblindness. The conservative colorblindness sees racial hierarchy is legally irrelevant to the constitutional principle of equal protection unless there is state-sponsored conscious intentional discrimination, and they don't want to do anything about it, and they want to talk about convincing racial marginalized group to adopt the proper cultural values so that they may take advantage of this new race-blind landscape. A prime proponent of that would be Justice Clarence Thomas. Liberal colorblindness, on the other hand, we'll admit that race does matter, but their admission is that it doesn't matter much. And they're willing, under some conditions, very limited conditions, to be race sensitive, but it's very limited. They view frontal attacks on racial conditions as divisive, so they particularly don't like a discussion of race either, if they can avoid it. And they spend a lot of time trying to convince racially marginalized groups to adopt the proper cultural values so that they may take advantage of that new race-blind landscape. A proponent of liberal colorblindness is President Barack Obama. And so it's clear, I wanted to use two African Americans to illustrate this point, because this point is not about race anymore. It's about a philosophy of life about how to deal with race, and it is seen in both black, it's seen in all groups, black, white, Native American, Hispanics, immigrants, non-immigrants. And so the prevalent question that I need people to think about is, how prevalent is colorblind racism in your life, in the life of your family and your friends? And which do you think is more prevalent, conservative or liberal colorblindness, and which is more stressful to deal with? Because at the end of the day, and this gets into why we are so unhealthy, the only difference, not the only, I mean, all of us have stressful lives. And it's stress due to racism that is the difference between African Americans and white Americans. And it's the history. In fact, there's some new research that is supporting that. Some of the newest research is showing that that we pass our history down through our genes. We are genetically the same, but our genes don't work the same way. Some research that is being done with Vietnam era veterans shows that stress to those Vietnam era veterans plays out in their children and grandchildren, because our genes are not a gene, but it's more like a switch box in which there's all these switches, and that when you get under stress, a switch in your gene turns on or off. And when that switch turns on or off, it impacts your health. And here's the real problem. It can take up to two generations for the gene, the switch, to turn back. Now, this is research that is called transgenic mutation, and it is research that is not based in African American. It's just general research. But if you apply it to the lives of African American, then you have to say, we have had no time in our life when we have had an opportunity to be healthy. We had the transatlantic slave trade and that voyage across the ocean, packed together, worse than cattle, people dying, people being thrown overboard because they were sick, and arriving in the American sick and dying. One of the things that people like that I hear African Americans say is that the fact that we arrived here alive shows that we have strong genes. And the reality is that the fact that we arrived here alive is because the voyage ended. If it had kept on a little bit longer, many of us would have died. Millions of people died in the transatlantic slave trade. They're talking about 100 million. You know, we talk about the Jewish Holocaust. Well, there's the transatlantic Holocaust. The slavery Holocaust had even more lives of people who were killed. And so we arrived on this continent sick. Okay. And stressed out. And so starts the pattern. We get freed from slavery, and then we have legal apartheid. More stress and no recovery. And then in 1964, which is the date that I marked the end of legal apartheid, we don't end racism, we just change it. And what we have is a historical record of deprivation, oppression, and current record that is embedded in wealth and income inequality, education, the criminal justice. I mean, every time I have to read about a black boy that has been shot to death doing nothing, I get stressed because I have black sons and I have black grandchildren. And I have to think, when I used to go shopping with my kids, I used to try to make it fun for them when we would get followed. Because I was like, okay, at least I can try to make this a game. That is a stressful life, to never know when you're going to be insulted, to have insults come at you continuously in different ways, and to know that your children and your grandchildren are subject to inequality in health care, inequality in housing, inequality in employment, inequality in food. I live in a food desert. And so when people say, well, people need to make better choices, I'm an old public health nurse, and I can tell you, if I had someone who was overweight sitting in front of me, I would counsel them about making better choices. But when they got up and left my table, if I really wanted them to make better choices, I would have to make sure that they had grocery stores that had fresh food and fruit in their community, which many urban communities do not, that they had parks and sidewalks, that they had quality public schools. So individual choices can only occur within the context of the environment in which people are born into. And as a result, as African Americans, the health of the parents affects the health of the child. And we have a slave health deficit. I have upper middle class children. My oldest son is a law professor, and my youngest son is an artist who's traveled worldwide. But because of this history, they will not have the health, no matter how much they exercise and how they eat. Statistically, their health is not going to be good as the white counterpart that they have. And because they're undergoing the stress of racism now. My son, my youngest son, who lived in England for 5 years, once said to me that he was in England almost a year before he stopped being afraid of the police over there. That he always felt apprehensive when a police would be walking towards him. And he's not to minimizing the racism that occurs in England, because England has its own set of problems. He's just saying the relationship between black Americans and police is in one in which black American men are stressed out because the police are not there to help, are not there to solve their problems. And now we have a prison industrial complex whose whole purpose is to put primarily black and brown people in jail so that people can make profit. And so I kind of wonder, this is kind of the background of where I want to end. Tomorrow I'm going to talk why a racialized system can't be fixed with class-based colorblind policies, why Obamacare fix the health disparities, and why the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is inadequate to address the 21st century discrimination. But what I would like to do for now is just talk about the health status of African Americans and the history of African Americans that has led up to that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Professor Randall, for a very great start to our two-part conversation. We'll take a little teeny tiny break just to get you enough time to have a sip of water or so, and okay, to get our audience, to get their questions ready for discussion at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. You're listening to Professor Randall. Professor Vanellia Randall, and she's discussing healthcare disparities. Of course, you just got a sense that it was a very political context, a socio-political context, psychological context, anthropological context, historical context. We'll come back to this discussion with your questions and comments right after this short break. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Our guest is Professor Vanellia Randall, and she's talking about healthcare disparities in the United States. Your calls and comments at 888-874-4888. And we'll take the first call very shortly. I want to ask you, Vanellia, when you say that there has been a genetic registration, if you will, if there's a genetic registration of stress, is it therefore to be assumed that every, or maybe every African-American person in the United States is somehow unhealthy in that sense?
Well, the question is that the how stress works, obviously, in our life, it is not everyone who is under stress has the same impact, okay? And so to the extent I ever say that every single African-American has had this impact, I'd say they're all at risk of having had that impact. And that if anybody in their life history had a switch turned off or on because of stress, then they are at much higher risk. And I think that that explains why people who are doing all the right things, who are African American, who was born in a middle class family, so second generation middle class people, eating like white people, exercising like white people, have more health problems than white people. So I'd say I would never say that every single African American has had this impact. I would say that they were all at risk of having that impact, and it explains the difference in our health status.
And with this information, let's say that about the potential stress sensitive genes, or the way that genes might be affected by stress, is this something that should be widely known among African Americans as part of their considering their health profile?
I think so. I think that any good doctor would need to counsel people about the stress. I think like anything, if you're talking about how to work on it, okay, you know, we don't have to take a defeatist attitude towards it. We could say, okay, if stress is at the root of it, then what we really need, is helping people to handle the stress, helping people to figure out how to, things they can do to manage stress. In the traditional sort of cancer program, hypertension program, depression, diabetes program, all which are stress-based disorders, okay, the traditional programs focus on eating right, exercising. But if stress is at the root of the difference, now I'm not saying people don't need to eat right and exercising. I'm saying unless you help people deal with the stress of racism, that eating right and exercising may not be enough, and in fact has proven not to be enough to make a difference for African Americans.
Thank you. Okay. Sherry from Stanford, you're on the air with Professor Vanellia Randall.
Hi. I agree with a lot of what you say. I really do think that stress is passed down from generation to generation, and this is still a very racist country. However, as a black American, having worked at a job that had many black Americans and people from other cultures, the thing that I observed was the diet of black Americans is very, very bad. Because I remember we had a dinner one time of black American food. It was fried, it was starchy, there was one vegetable, it was just a lot of sweet stuff, and it was really bad. And I saw the people from other cultures, we had a lot of Koreans working at the job. And they had much, much healthier food. Now, these people are making the same amount of money. So it wasn't a question of money. These people definitely could have gone out and bought better food. But because of generations of having, I don't know if it's slave food or processed food, it was just horrible. I mean, absolutely horrible. So
well,
I just wonder what your comments are about that.
Well, first of all, the challenge was a comparison of, there's a difference between, I compared Black Americans to white Americans, not to Korean Americans. And we can talk about what happens to immigrants. For instance, one of the things that happened to immigrants from wherever they come is they actually have better health when they get here, but within 10 years, their health turns poor, and while they're still eating the same diet, so that there is something going on that doesn't make their lives all that well, even though they're eating different. Secondly, I would challenge you to say that the diet is bad, is not as bad as the same class as white diets. That middle class white people eat a lot of fried food, that they're not eating all that well either. And that may be at the root of why white people's health is all not all that good when compared to the rest of the world. But I do not think diet explains the difference between white and black health. I do not think, you kept emphasizing it was really bad. I just don't think that black people's diet is all that worse than white people's diet of the same class.
Yeah, but like
and the
you
same
said, white
history.
People aren't that healthy either. White people in America aren't that healthy either. And
yes,
I agree with you, the racism adds another layer, but I do think that black Americans have, in a lot of cases, a very bad diet.
I don't agree with you.
Thank you, Sherry. Bob from Los Angeles, you're on the air with Dr. Vanellia Randall.
Hello, Professor, and hello, Latrice.
Hello.
Great show. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Oh, okay, great. I've been an activist for many years, going back to Vietnam, and I opened up the doors to the first non-white peace movement, and I'm very much grew up in blacks and Latinos. I am Latino. And going back to Selma and Montgomery, I was there. I am an activist, and I would like to, I think Latrice mentioned early in the beginning that we need to get this word out and let the world know that what you're talking about as far as major health problems with not only Obamacare, but the disparity of not only blacks, but Latinos also are getting this low end of everything. And I would like to know as an activist or as some of your thoughts, and I definitely want to stay in touch with you on that, how we can get the word out. I have some great ideas, but I want to get yours. Thank you.
Well,
thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much. I think getting on shows like this, and I think there's all kinds of networks, there's still an attempt to want to deal with their offices of minority health. So first of all, I would say to you, there are local offices of minority health all over the states, and they all are dealing with the disparities in health status of all the different population group. And I would suggest that I would be happy for you to get in touch with me and we can talk about it. One place to start is to start, with your own state office of minority health, who will be a better idea of what's going on in your state. I think that's where I would start. I think that's good. I think one of the issues, and I find it now, is that it is so much easier to want to deal with changing individual habits as the way to close the gap than to change the society in terms of racism as a way to close the gap. And I think people struggle with that. And I want to go back just a second to the other caller. I am not suggesting that we don't advise people to eat better. I'm suggesting that advising people to eat better won't close the gap, because the gap is not caused by how they eat. The gap is caused by the stress of racism.
That's a very good observation. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and we can take your calls. Allie, you're calling from New York.
Yes. Hi, Professor. I just wanted to mention to you that you're right. I noticed that Latinos, when they come into this country, even as a child or as a grown-up, they do gain, they eat the same food, and they gain a lot of weight. That is, I did notice that. And you remind me of Professor, the lady called Harriet Washington, when she talks about the racism, I mean, she talks about ethics. But she also talks about the racism in the medical field and how people of color have been treated in this country. But what I want you to do, can you please expand a little bit when you mentioned Clarence Thomas? Because I didn't get that part, and I would like you to explain what he had done. Can you please explain that? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for your question. All I was trying to do was use him as an example of someone who is believe in colorblindness, but is a conservative believer in colorblindness. And so if you follow what he does, Clarence Thomas is one of the most conservative people on the court, and he almost never thinks that race is an issue and that should be taken into consideration. And he's just an example of that, that conservative colorblindness just believes that racial hierarchy is legally irrelevant and that we ought not do anything about it unless the state sponsored it and unless it was intentional. Otherwise, any kind of racial disparity, racial inequality, racial injustice would just needs to be figured out without the courts or the law getting involved.
Vera from Brooklyn, you're on the air with Professor Randall.
Hello, Professor Randall. I'm so glad to hear what you have to say today, and thank you, Latrice, for having her on.
Thank you.
I concur with everything you've said about the racism affecting black, the stress of it affecting black folks and their health. And what my question has to do with the health system that we have, the so-called health care system that we have here in the United States, and maybe not just in the United States, it may be better at other places and worse at other places, but as far as here in the United States, with the profit motive being the driving force behind the health care system because of pharmaceuticals, do you think that if we could practice in this country homeopathic and holistic medicine, that it would alleviate some of the medical problems that blacks have?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and it goes to my discussion for tomorrow on the healthcare system and Obamacare and the Civil Rights Act. Because my focus is so much on the stress of racism as opposed to access to health care of any kind. See, I'm not really focusing on the impact that health care. I think the inequality in every system has to be gotten rid of. But you know what? I'll think about that and I'll work that in tomorrow, an answer to your question, when I talk about the health care system.
Well, thank you. As we close, Vanellia, what is coming tomorrow? Could you give us a brief synopsis of tomorrow's presentation?
Okay, tomorrow, what I plan to talk about, so what I've talked about up to this point is the whole idea that there's chronic stress from racism. We have all of these inequality in our society. What I'm going to talk about is the Civil Rights Act of 1964, why it can't get rid of the inequality that exists in our society, and I'm going to talk about Obamacare and why it not only can it not get rid of inequality, it's sort of a fraud in terms of saying that people will have health care. In fact, people will have insurance, and that's different than healthcare. Yeah, just a brief kind of statement here that I'll repeat tomorrow. When I was practicing in the 70s, many people had Medicaid, but they didn't have any health care because there was no doctor who would take the Medicaid. So you don't really have health care unless you have providers in your community. And Obamacare doesn't really address those issues. And so I'm going to talk about both the Civil Rights Act 1964. I'm going to talk about Obamacare. And then I'm going to propose a new human rights law. I don't want to call it a civil rights law for the 21st century that to deal with, because I think there is a legal reason why we have so much inequality. And I think that it can be legally corrected. It won't get rid of racism, but it will reduce inequality.
Well, thank you.
We
look forward to your lecture tomorrow, the second part of this two-part presentation, but really, really interesting ideas already advanced. I look forward to tomorrow. Thanks, Vanellia, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Well, I hope that you had some information to cogitate upon, and you will be back here tomorrow, same time, for the conclusion of this two-parter. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You could reach me at leadstories@gmail.com, and feel free to always express yourself on the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. See you tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today.